Welcome back, Amazon sellers, to another exciting episode of our podcast. Today, our special guest, Daniel, better known as 1000ASINS, sold almost 13 million last year. He is able to achieve this remarkable feat within the 6 years he's been selling on Amazon. Join us as Daniel shares how he plans to scale up to 20 million in sales this year and the biggest challenges he faces and how he sees his Amazon business evolving in the future. Check it out. Welcome to the next Amazon Top Seller Podcast. Stay updated with the latest Amazon news and learn the nitty-gritty of selling on Amazon through BeCool's years of experience in the Amazon world. I'm Nick, and I'm the host of this podcast brought to you by the fantastic Amazon experts at BeCool. Let's start our journey to become the next Amazon Top Seller.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Today, BeCool invited Daniel, also known as 1000ASINS. He started to sell on Amazon since 2018 from his apartment, and now he's earning eight figures in annual sales every year while running his own prep centers. Today, he's going to tell us how he turned his life around during the pandemic and keep growing his business strong. Let's welcome Daniel to our channel today.
Hello. Yeah, thanks for the introduction, and happy to be here. Excited to chat.
Daniel, could you introduce yourself and why the name 1000ASINS?
Yeah, sure. So I've been selling on Amazon for about 5 or 6 years. Before that, I was a real estate agent and just a regular guy who decided to sell on Amazon. And I've grown it from a very small side hustle from my apartment into a fairly large business. And I picked the name 1000ASINS because early on in my Amazon selling, I kind of immediately saw the power of what Amazon could be, because I found, you know, if my first few products, they make a few hundred dollars profit a month. And then I just thought, as long as you find more products, you can keep scaling and scaling and scaling infinitely. And that uncapped earnings potential was really appealing to me, that all I had to do to make more money was just find more products and stay in stock of those products and just add more and more and more. And I did some math. If I got to 1,000 products and they made $100 each per month, then, you know, I would be clearing over $1 million a year, which was pretty mind-blowing to me. So the challenge for me became just logistically trying to purchase and stay in stock of, you know, a wide variety of products, even if a single product may not make you rich in and of itself, but the accumulation of a lot of different products. So I just had that in the back of my head as kind of my philosophy. And that's why I created the name 1000ASINS, but it was fairly arbitrary. But yeah, it kind of also outlines my general Amazon philosophy. So
the idea is, as you add more listings, each listing is profitable. And if you get to 1,000, then you can make $1 million profits.
$1 million a year. Yeah.
$1 million a year. That was the original concept.
Yeah, basically.
And what was the first item that you sold and how did you find it?
The very first item I sold was, I think it was a mug before Stanley mugs became all the rage. It was like a vacuum sealed mug. And I literally just walked from my apartment when I was living in Jersey City into a Target, I think. And I'd seen a couple of YouTube videos about how to use a scanning app, scan UPCs in the store, see if you can resell it for a profit. So went around with my scanning app. I don't even remember what the app's called anymore. And I was just scanning items at random and then coming up short until I stumbled across some of these mugs. And they're on clearance for $5, and then they were selling for like $30 on Amazon. So I think I bought like 5 of them just to check it out. And that was my very first product. I sent it in, learned the ropes on how to create a shipment and, you know, Seller Central, all the basics, sent it in, and all 5 sold in like a day or two. And I'm like, wow, that was pretty cool. Then from there, I, you know, went back to the store and got some more products.
So you repeated that over and over again. And what's the key to scaling up on Amazon, like from 6-7 figures to 8 figures?
You know, I think a lot of people start out as a one-man show, which is perfectly fine. And you probably should do that to learn all the ins and outs of, you know, how everything works. And that'll get you pretty far, actually. I think I got to maybe 500,000 of revenue, like within the first 12 months of selling on Amazon. And that was all kind of solo, you know, all the prep, all the sourcing, all the everything. And then you just get to this point where you can't do anymore. Like, you run out of hours in the day or you'll get burnt out. So the key to scaling in Amazon and to anything is to delegate a lot of the tasks to other people. So first, break down what tasks are involved in running an Amazon business. And I just like brain dumped everything, like hundreds and hundreds of little things that I do throughout the day. And then maybe then organize it by department or like, you know, group it by something to figure out like the different pieces. And then you can then categorize all those little things like, what can others do? What can I do? What am I good at? What am I bad at? What do I hate doing, love doing? You know, you can put it all into all these different buckets, and then it'll become sort of obvious the first things you should delegate. And then you can kind of like move up the list as you continue to grow. So in my personal experience, the first thing I delegated was the prep. So if you're prepping your own products, you're essentially giving yourself a job for, you know, $15 to $20 an hour. You're giving yourself an entry-level job. And I think you should do that at the very beginning to understand prep, understand labeling requirements, prep requirements. But as soon as your business starts generating more than that in terms of like an hourly salary, I think you should go ahead and then delegate the prep part. So that's what I did. And that was the first logical thing to delegate. So yeah, that's my basic formula for scaling.
So the formula for you, the first thing you delegate was prepping. And when you're saying delegate, are you talking about delegating it to a prep setter, delegated to hiring people to help you ship FBM? Or what do you mean when you're saying?
Either. You could delegate it either to a professional service that does it, which is a really easy way to delegate something, or you could delegate it to someone that you hire and manage in-house. And there's pros and cons to either. You know, if you delegate something to a prep center, it's going to be a lot more streamlined and of a process and easy to manage. However, there's going to be a price premium for that, for all that convenience. So I think actually at first you probably should delegate to a prep center. And I wouldn't consider having your own employees and warehouse until you get to probably at least 7 figures a year of revenue. Then it might be time to look into leasing a 1,000 or 2,000 foot space and hiring a full-time prep employee or two. But as you're going, you know, there's a lot of fixed costs involved with setting up your own prep operation warehouse. So I would say be sure that you're going to be doing this and get to a pretty reasonable level before taking it all in-house, because there's a lot of costs associated. Running a prep center, you know, I know all the costs associated with prep that people don't think about. It's like, it's not just labor cost. It's supplies, it's rent, it's insurance, it's utilities, it's maintenance, and there's a long, long list. Even my own internal price per unit to prep on my selling business is probably about 60 to 70 cents a unit. Don't get it confused. Like if you do it yourself, you're not going to save as much money as you think doing it yourself versus hiring a prep center. But at the end of the day, prep center will be more expensive, but also a lot easier. Like hiring people, managing people, firing people, it's a lot of work and it's a lot of stress. If you can avoid all that stuff, then I'd say delegating to a prep center is actually preferable than trying to start it from scratch yourself until you get to a certain point.
My understanding is you also run a prep center as well.
Yes. And
when you're picking a prep center, what are some important things to look at?
I'd say number one is communication. You want to find a prep center where you can communicate with that prep center. Early in my journey, I used prep centers. And the most infuriating thing about it, I thought, was that if there's any sort of problem or question you had to like fill out a form on the website and like, you know, type your name, type your email, type your phone number, type all your comments, and then you'd submit the ticket. And then 3 days later, someone might get back to you and they might even misinterpret the question. And then you're like, oh, this is such a disaster. So that's one thing I wanted to fix with my prep center. Like, so we create dedicated Slack channels for every customer that we have where you can basically reach someone in real time. And, you know, we may not respond in 10 seconds, but we're going to get back to you. And then if someone's at a computer, we can have a back and forth conversation about something, which is just often much easier. And then, you know, I offer my own personal phone number for any emergencies. Like if something's really critical, like, you know, they can call me, text me, call my manager, text my manager. And I don't know, for me, that was important, just good communication. Secondly, I'd say, you know, turnaround time. A lot of prep centers will promise 2-day turnaround time and products might be sitting there for like 2 or 3 weeks. And then during Q4, it could be even longer. And the prep business is not easy. I sympathize with both sides of the coin now, having my own prep center. But you do need a prep center that's organized enough to know which clients they've prepped and when, and whose stuff has been sitting the longest, and, you know, some sort of prioritization system and organized system to deal with various different products and keeping your inventory straight and receiving against the proper tracking numbers. A lot of prep centers will just use a Google sheet essentially, and using spreadsheets, unless they're very built out and sophisticated spreadsheets, it's going to turn into an absolute disaster, almost guaranteed, as you go high volume. So our prep center, we use a software that keeps everything straight. We receive, again, specific tracking numbers, order numbers. There's full visibility throughout the whole place. You can see when your package was delivered, when something was received, how much was sent out, and then any sort of problems, you know, shortages, misships, damage, you know, you name it. There's problem ticket system that keeps everything nice and organized. So, and then lastly, I guess, would be price. You know, you don't want to necessarily go blindly the first prep center you see. You should compare prices, get an idea and of what's out there, and not overpay and maybe not underpay either. There's some prep centers that promise some crazy low rates, and I would almost guarantee you that there are going to be problems if the price seems too good to be true. So yeah, that's my advice on choosing a prep center.
So communication, and then also the turnaround time for them to send it to Amazon FBA for you, or if they're doing FBM for you, and then also the pricing, you know, looking between $1 to $1.40, you know, depending, you know, if you need a poly bag and, you know, other requirements that you might have. Now let's move back a little bit. You know, I want to ask you, like, why do many sellers stop growing at 7 figures per year and they don't continue to grow to the next level?
Yeah, I think that's right around the area where you need to stop becoming a one-man show and start building a team. And I think that's the stumbling point for a lot of people. So I threw out that like 500K or a million revenue number. Right. And I think that's just about where you start getting capped out. You make a decent living, you'll make 100 grand, 200 grand in a year. And you know, that's great, but you do have to make that leap of entrusting someone else to handle other parts of your business. And I remember for me, it was pretty difficult to do. I had this big fear that if I hire someone, he's not going to label accurately, and he might put 100 labels of the wrong FNSQ label on the wrong product. We're going to send it to Amazon, and then the customers are going to order the wrong product because Amazon received it wrong, and then I have to remove all the stuff. And you know, so I had these like nightmare scenarios of like losing thousands and thousands, or just not thinking an entry-level employee would be capable of that type of accuracy. So at first I was reluctant to hire someone and kind of like micromanaged a lot of the stuff. And then over time I realized that people are capable of more than you think they are, especially with clear training. So I'm much more comfortable now delegating and telling people to figure stuff out and let me know if like you can't, but you know, tell me what you figured out and let me know. And that's the growth process I think you need, like personally and as a company to scale, you need to trust others. And that's why I think right around that point is where people get stuck.
So the recommendation is, you know, you need to start delegating. You might need to grow your team to offload some of the other tasks in order for you to scale up more. Are there other tips you have for 6 and 7 figure sellers?
I would always be doing outreach. And then I guess another part of scaling is not looking for your next deal. So like the nature of what you're buying can also shift as you scale. So I remember when I was at that like 500K to a million revenue point, I was looking for like the next arbitrage deal. It's like the next sale, the next thing that was on a lead list that looked good. And like, that's not like a sustainable business. That's kind of a hustle, and it's a great hustle. I recommend it. But eventually, if you want to put up huge numbers, you're going to need some replenishable products that sell fast day in and day out. So you're only as good as your next deal if you have that mentality. And it's really hard to do 10 or 20 or $30 million in revenue, just finding the next deal and finding more of those deals. And then all of a sudden, to even be able to put up those numbers, you may need to find 50 new products every single day because the old products you're selling no longer work for various reasons, like the sales over or the price tanked or something like that. So arbitrage can be done at scale, but you need, I think it's almost necessary to do either replenishable products or have some really, really good hookups where you can buy massive quantity regularly. So yeah, that's another, I guess, roadblock to scaling. It's like what types of things you're buying.
Talking about that, you know, sourcing products that you can continue to get over and over again, replenishable items, or maybe it's wholesale items you can have access to. What is a secret to reaching, in your case, you said $13, $14 million last year in sales on Amazon, and then you want to go for even higher amount, maybe $20 million this year. What is the secret to reaching this type of sales?
Well, that's the beauty of it. There isn't really this big secret. It's just accumulating more and more and more products. I think people underestimate the power of just a single good SKU that has price stability and is profitable. Like, you know, one SKU that they make $400 a month profit, you know, times 12, that's $5,000 a year. And then you just add another one and another one and another one and another one. And that's kind of what I love about it, that it doesn't get like infinitely more complex as you go. It's just like finding those stable, profitable SKUs, which, you know, it's not all that easy to do that, but it is very possible if you put in the work. And you just take a supplier, you maximize all the stuff they have in their catalog, figure it out, and then buy that stuff and then stay in stock of it and don't even move on until, you know, you have the capital to consistently stay in stock of those products. And then, you know, once you have an excess of capital, go find another supplier and maximize that relationship too, and then add another one and another one. And that's really it. My whole growth strategy for the coming years is just copy pasting my existing strategy. And speaking of staying in stock, I mean, I even realized that for my own business, I'm doing kind of a horrible job of staying in stock. Like, I'm stocking out all the time of products, and I believe my business could 2 to 3x in size just by doing a better job of ordering with the appropriate lead times and staying in stock of the products I have. And then I realized when I tried to actually do that, I ran out of capital, because cash flow is kind of always tight in an inventory business. So now my new thing is I'm trying to raise like $2 or $3 million, not raise it, but borrow it to fuel that additional growth, just stay in stock of what I have. So I think a lot of new sellers will sell through something once and then like never buy it again for some reason, but they can look to buy it again and keep buying it and go heavier. Like a lot of new arbitrage sellers, they'll buy 10 units of something, they'll sell in 2 days, and they're like, okay, what's next on the lead list? It's like, no, go back to that product, it worked. So now do everything you can to get 30 times as much of it to stay in stock constantly. Kind of went off on a little tangent there, but yeah, kind of, but I think about that.
What's your criteria when you're selecting products? Let's say we're looking at wholesale items. What ROIs are you looking for? Are you looking for a certain number of units sold per month? You know, or bestseller ranking drops? Like for you, what's your criteria?
Yeah, my criteria are pretty basic. So one is no Amazon or Amazon stocking out most of the time. I don't like to go head to head with Amazon. Two, there's more than like one or two FBA sellers on it. I'm making sure the brand is not selling the product themselves on it, FBA, and that they don't have an exclusive with one big seller. So I'm looking for multiple sellers, you know, anywhere from 3 up to, you know, 30 or 40 is still actually feasible sometimes. So multiple FBA sellers. I'm looking for price stability, where I'm not seeing this pattern of a bunch if sellers coming on a listing, then the price goes to break even or losing, and then people sell through, and then it's good again, then it's bad again, then it's good again. A lot of arbitrage products follow that pattern. So with wholesale, I'm looking back at the sales history and making sure it never like lost money for a long period of time and that things are fairly stable. Then in terms of velocity, my kind of like minimum profit threshold is like at least $100 of profit per month. So, you know, that could mean a higher ticket item selling less frequently or a cheap item selling more frequently. And then in terms of ROI and margin, I pretty much won't touch anything under 10% margin and like 15 to 20% ROI. And that's the lowest I'll go. And it's all kind of a sliding scale. Something will sell extremely fast, I'm willing to take a lower ROI and margin because I can get that ROI faster. And, you know, the slower something sells or the cheaper it is, like it would have to be higher margin and ROI for me to be excited about it. And then most things are in the middle. Wholesale typically, I think, is in that like 12 to 20% profit range. Actually, it can go much higher than 20%. I'm going to say 30%. I have some really good SKUs that are 25, 30% net profit margin. So they're out there on average, you know, 15 to 20%, I'd say, at an ROI of 30 to 50%. I think that's kind of like the sweet spot for wholesale.
What does a day-to-day look like when you're running an eight-figure business on Amazon?
Yeah, my day-to-day, I come in. So my staff, I have like 6 people full-time in the warehouse, a warehouse manager. Then I have a full-time buyer. And then I have a multi-channel manager who's actually putting my catalog on eBay, Walmart, TikTok, Amazon Canada. Like we're trying to spread out to different channels. And then I have a COO who I recently just hired, who's kind of taking over what I would normally do in a day, which is, you know, the high level stuff, just checking like finances, paying off whatever cards I need to pay off, like looking at cash flow, approving purchase orders that my buyer's doing, making sure shipments are going out on time, a bunch of emails, like email, you know, relationships with my existing suppliers, and kind of just directing people what to do. And then I do spend some of my time doing my own purchase orders as well, because that's just something I enjoy doing. going through a supplier, all the SKUs, what should I buy next? And yeah, that's kind of it. And then with my COO, I'm basically just backing off to become more of a passive owner where I don't even really have to show up anymore. And then I'm focusing on like the strategic direction of the business, you know, raising capital and what types of things we can do for brands and want to do with brands and becoming the best possible seller to work with that a brand would want to work with. So those are the types of things I'm thinking about now, not just becoming a reseller, like just a random entity that buys some product and sells the product. We want to be more advisory to them as well and show expertise in like A+ content and advertising and, you know, other topics like that. So I'm focused on creating like a product around what we're doing, which, you know, the mega sellers out there have already done, like Pattern or Caspian or Spreetail. You know, if you check out their websites, they are brand incubators. They're not resellers. So like, even though they are resellers, they kind of position themselves that way. So that's kind of what I'm focusing on. So yeah, my evolution in terms of like my day-to-day used to be everything, including a lot of product prep. Delegated that. Then it was more like purchasing and seller central account management. Then I delegated purchasing. And then I dealt with like, you know, payroll, hiring, firing, SOPs, making decisions on software, paying bills, all that stuff. And now I'm delegating that stuff too. And now I have nothing left to do. So I'm going to be pretty bored pretty soon, I think.
What's the biggest challenge for you, like when you're managing all of these different, you know, things you have to juggle around at this point in your business?
Yeah, the challenge is for me right now is getting stuck in the weeds. So like running an Amazon business and probably any small business as the owner, you get pulled in a million different directions. Like you sit down, you plan on doing one thing, and then you see your email and you're like, ooh, I have to respond to that. And then next thing you know, you're bouncing around 20 different tasks kind of haphazardly. And if I'm not careful, I can do that kind of like busy work all day long and not really advance like the major initiatives of the business. So I'm trying to focus on not getting in the weeds and allowing other people to do some of the things that I'd normally want to like control. So again, it's like a control thing. I'm like, I used to want to control the prep stuff and then control the buying stuff. But I'm kind of just like trying to take my hands away from it and like still create metrics to like evaluate performance and hold people accountable, but not like control the specifics on how things are done. So yeah, that's kind of how I'm trying to evolve as an owner.
So stepping back, not getting involved in the daily weeds, as you mentioned, or things that have to be taken care of, and then, you know, letting your team handle a lot of those issues. And then you talk a little bit about like talking to suppliers and brands. When you're sourcing items now, like, is it different than before when you're doing 6-7 figures? Because when you're sourcing, are you talking to brands more, you know, or distributors, or how does it work?
Yeah, we're doing a lot of brand direct actually, which is nice. And if we can't get a brand direct deal, sometimes they'll refer us to distributors and then we'll actually find some pretty decent distributors that way. So we randomly sell a good amount of pool supplies, and we initially got into that niche by contacting a brand directly, and they said, we don't sell direct to retailers at all, just through distribution. You can contact distributor, and here's our manufacturer rep. He'll give you a call. He gave me a call and then, you know, pointed me towards a couple possible distributors, and then I opened an account with them, bought just that brand for a while, and then ventured into other brands that this distributor carried. And it's kind of cool when you do that, because you can approach brands within a niche and be like, hey, we actually sell your like biggest competitor. We do a ton of volume with them. We spend, you know, $1 million a year with your competitor. Like, would you be willing to take us on as like a retailer for your brand too? And then they kind of like fall by like dominoes. And now we have like probably most of the big pool brands. And then that gives you more street cred. Like, oh, they're already working with like all of my competition. I better sell to them too, type of thing. So yeah, in general, the strategy is like work with brands directly. If you can, you can typically get the deepest discounts that way. If they won't sell to you, try and see if they can point you towards a distributor. Sometimes they'll say like, no, we just don't want anything to do with Amazon or you, and screw off, type of thing. And that happens a bunch. But yeah, we try and go brand first. Works more than you think it would. And then if not, a distributor. And so we're working with both right now.
What type of capital do you need when you're talking to like the most brands that you talk about? Like, how much are they looking MOQ? And
I don't know, less than you think, but also more than you think. So like, you don't need millions liquid. You don't need to spend 2-3 million with a brand right off the bat. Like, we typically will do orders of like 100 or 200K right off the bat. And that's like shows you're kind of serious and can get into like the lowest pricing tier. If you come and try to do wholesale with like 5K, you can probably do it with some like very small brands or distributors and find like a few products that work well. But if you're going to like a high velocity, high in demand brand, if you're trying to be like one of a few Amazon sellers, you pretty much have to throw money at it and do, you know, these six figure orders pretty much, you know, monthly or every month. And that's just kind of the name of the game in wholesale. Like you basically have to throw money at the problem and you have to have a significant amount to get the best accounts. And that's just the way it is. So I'd say if capital is limited, like use arbitrage to build capital. Then start with some really small wholesale accounts. And then once you have a significant amount of dollars or at least credit card, available credit to swing around, then you can start to have those conversations with brands. So we'll just be very blatant about it. We'll just be like, yeah, we buy by the truckloads. We have a bunch of brand referrals. Like our sales are, you know, eight figures. Here's our website. And it just looks so much more legit than a random Gmail address saying like, what's the minimum we can order? No one wants to hear minimum order quantities. They want to hear like maximum order quantities, large orders. So that's kind of our strategy and it's almost necessary to get the pricing you need to make wholesale work. Because Amazon wholesale is pretty competitive. You're dealing with a lot of mega sellers with pretty deep pockets. So
let's move on and talk a little bit about the tools that you use. And I'm wondering, why is it necessary to use a repricer?
Yeah, repricer is absolutely critical because, well, everyone else has a repricer. So you're going to be left in the dust if you're not competing with them. So your first few products, I get it. Like you can go in and check the price. Are you priced competitively? Sure. Or if you're not, you can, you know, manually lower down the price. But once you get to probably 20, 30 SKUs, not even that many, you're going to want and need a repricer, because what's going to happen is other sellers with repricers, they'll go a penny below you, you'll lose the buy box, and then you'll be sitting on inventory and wondering why. And the reason why is someone has likely undercut you by just a penny. And to level the playing field, you basically need a repricer. And just as important as going down in price, a repricer will make you a lot more profit and going up in price. So like, let's say most people sold through on a listing and you're one of the last ones left. Without a repricer, you might blow through your inventory at $10 less a unit than you could have had you just had a repricer go up to a higher price. If you tell it, you know, if you're the last person left, you know, raise it way up in price. So it goes two ways. And it's just something, I mean, pricing, you can think about it as a task to delegate and automate just like any other task. And you want to just let the computers do the heavy lifting for you and pricing down, pricing up, applying logic to the repricing rules. It's there's not even a conversation to be had about whether it's necessary or not. It is necessary to have a repricer once you hit, you know, 10, 20 plus SKUs.
And what do you think about the BeQuil repricer, your opinion?
I like BeQuil a lot. I think it's actually a great entry-level repricer, and not just for entry-level sellers, but, you know, a great entry point getting into a repricer because the pricing is the best I've found over the past 5 years. I mean, I know it's out there and BeQuil is the best value and the lowest price, I think, for starting with a repricer. So, and I've used BeQuil and it works. That's plain and simple. So yeah, I think there's nothing bad to say. It's probably the best value of any repricer I've come across. And, you know, they have flexibility with the rules you can apply for different objectives. And then now there's AI repricing, which is like the cutting edge of repricing as well. So yeah, absolutely recommend.
How do you usually price a wholesale product with a repricer?
I'll set a minimum max price. The minimum is usually some sort of minimum ROI requirement. And the max is usually some very premium price where I'll get, you know, 30, 40% margin if I happen to get sales at that price. So you want to be aware of what type of ROI margin your minimum would get in the worst case scenario that the price goes all the way down to your minimum. People are varying degrees of aggressive with that. Some people like to always be moving product no matter what, even at a slight loss, just to get capital back and recycle it into more profitable products. Other people are kind of in the middle. It's like, okay, as long as I break even, you know, I'm good. And then others will be like, I am not selling this product, period, unless I make, you know, 10% ROI or 20% ROI. So it's really up to you, the seller, as to how aggressive you want to be with your minimum price. And then same for maximum price. You really want to milk people for all they're worth, like if you're the last person left and you're at your max price, or do you want to be semi-reasonable and sell it at a good margin, but sell it a little faster than, you know, waiting out for that buyer who really wants it at any price type of thing. So that a lot of that is personal preference, but you know, it starts with a min and a max, and then the different rules that BeCool has will dictate, you know, how the price is moving up and down and how aggressive you want to be, or whether profit is the goal or buy box share is the goal, you know, various different goals, which is nice that you have that flexibility. And that may vary by product or by brand or by supplier. So you don't necessarily need a one size fits all rule.
What do you usually do with items that don't sell?
So there are a few things you can do. So you can get really aggressive with your repricer and you can sell it at even a loss. You know, in general, the lower price something is, the more people will buy it. And then, you know, demand picks up. You can also run promotions or advertising on the product. So you can create a coupon, it's called, where it'll be, you know, a little like $1 off, $2 off thing, which will show when people are browsing. It's just something flashy and that will draw more clicks to the listing. You can also do pay-per-click advertising. You know, you could run some campaigns. If you're, I mean, advertising is a whole different beast and there's a lot to learn there. But if you're good with it, you can really move product that's stale really well if you put in the right keywords. And you know, it costs money, but in my opinion, once something has been sitting for a few months, I mean, you've kind of lost on the product unless you know it's seasonal and it's going to pick up at a certain time in the future. But so then your priority really is like capital recovery. And you have to be cognizant of like Amazon storage fees. Like for every month that those products sit in there, like you're paying more than you think you are just to have them at Amazon. So it's really imperative to recover whatever money you can back from the product. And you know, if something is really, really not moving, you always have the option to remove it from Amazon through a removal order. Although that's gotten pretty expensive every year, those prices are going up. And then if you're at a complete and total loss, you can do Amazon liquidations where you might get, you know, 5 or 10% of the sale price back. And if they can't liquidate it, then you may have to just dispose of it or have Amazon dispose of it. So fortunately on Amazon, that doesn't happen too often. Like my win rate with products is probably 95% plus, but there are various things that can go wrong with products and you can't get too hung up on any one product. You got to kind of zoom out and see the big picture. Like if you're winning most of the time, you're doing right. So yeah, once a product's been sitting, get aggressive with price, run promotions, remove it if necessary, and just try and recover your capital.
Got it. So there's different ways that you could do to focus on capital recovery, as you mentioned.
Yeah, fancy term for getting your money back. Yeah.
Right, getting your money back, right? And then yeah. I guess when you're sourcing the item, you want to reduce the risk, right? So if you want to make, if there's a higher risk, then you definitely need a higher margins. This way, you're still a buffer for some of your min prices. Yeah. If you want to decide to lower the price, you want to run some coupons, or if you have some budget to run some ads as well. Now, talking about ads, like what plans do you have for your private label business?
That's actually the direction I want to probably take my entire business over time, or keep the wholesale as a cash generator and then invest significant money into creating, you know, real brands on Amazon that will do well and hopefully sell down the road. So my plan is to transition actually from wholesale into focusing on private label. My private label endeavors thus far have been moderately successful to complete failures. I haven't really hit that right product yet. So I'm still learning private label. It's a whole different game. It's a tougher game, in my opinion, I think. And it takes a lot of money and a lot of investment into like ad spend upfront. But then the payoff at the end is also greater. So just kind of a different game. I've put my private label plans kind of on hold. I have a couple things that do okay, like a couple of private label SKUs that make some money and I'll replenish them, but they're not home runs. Yeah, for me right now, I'm just kind of getting the wholesale business to a really, really good place where it's spitting off a lot of money. And then I'm going to do private label in earnest, go all the way in, not just, you know, dip my toes in the water like I did the last couple of times. I don't think it's something these days you can go halfway with anymore. I think like the Alibaba private label make $1 million days are kind of gone, or at least much tougher.
Yeah, it's extremely competitive. Why do you want to have your own brand and, you know, move into the private label business? What's the motivation behind that?
The motivation is primarily like exit opportunities. I've met some people at Amazon conferences and online, and I'm a little jealous that they started a brand, it blew up, 2 or 3 years later, they got to exit it for like 30, 40 million. And then they have like retire the rest of your life type of money. And that was inspiring to me. And also I think it can be more rewarding, like building something that's your own rather than reselling other brand name products. Over time, it's like, I feel with all these brands I'm working with, like I'm happy to be a really good partner for them, but you know, I'm contributing ad spend into someone else's brand and like doing a lot of work for someone else's brand. And a lot of that Amazon work I know how to do. So I might as well put the rest of the puzzle together and like source the right products at the right time and like create a brand around it. And then I already have half of the equation. So like, why not complete the other half instead of, you know, kind of like sucking up to a bunch of other brands, you know, if that makes sense. So I kind of just want something of my own and the exit opportunities are great. Whereas this wholesale business, I could probably sell it for like a 1 or 2x income multiple, you know, maybe cash out for a few million, but nothing like a successful brand that can get a much higher sale price for the business. So, and you can do it again and again too. That's the thing. It's like, if you sell a brand, start another one or have multiple. So I don't know, that kind of excites me. And it's kind of like the end game for Amazon's, in my opinion, it's kind of like the big leagues. Wholesale is kind of like the intermediate stepping stone. Arbitrage might be the first stepping stone. So yeah, that's kind of where I want to journey to.
Talking about that, like, do you still recommend people doing Amazon in 2024? How would they compete with larger wholesalers like you?
I would absolutely recommend Amazon, selling on Amazon still. As you can see, Amazon's revenue is still growing. The proportion of third-party sales revenue is still growing. I mean, we're in a golden age here, in my opinion. The golden age is continuing. And the truth is, like, there are just so many brands out there that not everyone's going to have it together and, like, sell exclusively and police Amazon like crazy. I think the ocean is so friggin' big that there's going to be arbitrage opportunities as long as the platform exists. So there's still plenty of opportunity out there for arbitrage. And then for wholesale, you can still, there are a lot of small wholesale accounts where you don't necessarily have to compete against mega sellers. It's just trying to find the golden nuggets wherever you can, like turning over a bunch of stones. And like, I think it's really just a function of, if you just do the work and try and reach out to suppliers, you will find them. You may not get the accounts that, you know, will make you millions of revenue without a lot of money, but you're going to get enough. And then, yeah, you can just work your way up over time. That's kind of what we've done. And even the mega sellers, it's like they make mistakes, they stock out, they may lose relationships. Everything is so fluid and dynamic that there's just bursting with opportunities to capitalize on, I think. So yeah, I would absolutely recommend selling on Amazon still.
Yeah. How did Amazon business change your life?
Obviously, the money part of it is great. Like, I'm financially much more comfortable than I used to, having a business that's generating a lot of income. So that's the obvious, it goes without saying. But actually, the most fun part of this whole thing has been like the Amazon community. It's kind of one of those things where like, if anyone on Instagram or online happens to be an Amazon seller, there's kind of like an instant camaraderie. You're like, hey, let's be friends. We know about selling on Amazon. And I guess I was missing that from like my prior career. I was felt kind of isolated on my own. And selling on Amazon can be isolating if you're trying to do it on your own, but there's also a community at the same time. And through, you know, going to seller conferences and events and sharing my journey on Instagram and social media, I've actually made a bunch of friends. And it's really cool that I can visit like almost any major city in the United States and even globally some places, and I can have what I consider like an Amazon seller friend, and they're down to get dinner, go out for drinks and talk shop and all that stuff. So that's been really awesome. And owning a business is like constantly challenging me to level up, essentially. Like every year I feel like I need to level up in some way to keep the growth growing. And it's kind of a fun game, like to see how far you can push it, type of thing. So I love everything about it. It's rare to say like you're satisfied with your career. I think there are a lot of people out there that aren't, probably the vast majority of people aren't, aside from the money, which is great, don't get me wrong. But it's just, I enjoy the job. I enjoy everything about it. So
it seems you find purpose and you feel a lot more satisfied with what you're doing. Why is it important for Amazon sellers to have a social media presence?
I think you can learn a lot from other sellers, because if you don't network with other sellers, you're going to do things the way you figured out how to do it, which may be a great way to do it, or maybe a really crappy way to do it. And I've learned a lot of things just like discussing like, oh, how do you do this? And how do you do that? And running an Amazon business is a lot of like little, like 200 or 300 little tasks, like how to do this, how to do that. Every little edge you can find, every little like best practice, like, oh, you do it this way, this is like way more efficient than I was doing it. That makes you a better Amazon seller and more well-rounded. And So I think the primary reason to do it would be learning, and then also networking if that's something you're seeking. It's by no means necessary. I mean, for every Instagram you know, Amazon guru there is. There's 10 or 100 people doing the same numbers or better numbers that are just keeping to themselves. It's, you know, it's by no means a necessity, but for me, it's actually been one of the funnest parts, just like networking with other people through social media. When I started the Instagram, I had absolutely no agenda, and I still don't. I just like interacting and posting stuff. And so, yeah, I think if you want to learn from others and, or you find the job to be lonely, if you're all alone in your garage, then, you know, I would take to social media and try and network. So
what did you share with some of the people that you've met, like that you've networked with? Like, what are some things that you shouldn't share?
I wouldn't overshare, sort of like, hey, this supplier will open up the account. And I've actually even done that when I don't care, when there's like a dozen sellers on it, like, I'll be like, oh yeah, you could probably sell that too. I don't care. But in general, yeah, you don't want to give away like all your suppliers and your techniques of how to get the best price on certain things. So it's like, there's a lot you can share, but there's, you know, it's kind of the unwritten rule. Like, you don't share your products, you don't share your Amazon store name. Otherwise they can click on your store and be like, oh, this guy's selling all these. And he's doing well, so let me get on every single product that this guy's getting on, and then contact all your suppliers and all that stuff. So you don't want to create competition for yourself necessarily. As long as you keep like the specifics kind of vague of like what you're selling, everything else, in my opinion, can be shared. Like what software tools you're using, the best way to prep items, the most efficient ways to do things, any like reports or like systems or procedures. I think all that stuff can be shared with absolutely no detriment like to your own business.
So the confidential information, the suppliers, ways you can even get, you know, lower discounts, and also potential like the actual ASINs that you're selling. Like those would definitely be information you probably want to keep to yourself.
Sure.
What about buying products together with other Amazon sellers?
I've done that. And yeah, as long as you're like, you know, in a group where people trust each other, a lot of times there's more to go around than anyone can possibly buy on their own. So like a big Nike sale or something like that, where you're going to run out of money before you run out of stuff to buy. That type of thing, you know, you and a few close seller friends be like, check this out, man. Like, just go and get everything you can. And then, you know, people get what they get, that type of thing. Yeah, that's a lot of fun. The danger of that, like, you know, that person could tell a friend, then it ends up on a lead list, and then 100 people are buying it, and then the product's kind of ruined when, you know, a bunch of sellers come on. So you want to just like walk the fine line, I guess, sharing with people you trust, and, you know, versus blasting it out to anyone who will listen, you know, if there's a good deal on something. So,
Daniel, where can people find you and follow you on your social media?
Yeah, so I'm pretty much only on one social media platform. I'm on Instagram, and my handle there is 1000 ASINS. So the number 1000 ASINS, A-S-I-N-S. And yeah, that's, you can follow the journey. And I guess I'll self-promote my prep center for a second too. I do offer prep services for online arbitrage. We're in a sales tax-free state in New Hampshire, and we're taking on new clients right now. So if there's any interest there, you can go to my prep center website, which is epicprepllc.com. There's a contact form, and just fill that out, and I'll get back to you with, you know, the pricing and all the specifics, and yeah, I'd be happy to take on some new business there as well. So, and feel free to shoot me a DM on Instagram too. Happy to connect with whoever.
So if you're watching this, everyone, make sure to follow Daniel on his Instagram to learn more about selling, about scaling up, get to the next level, and also check out his prep center if you're looking to look at different prep centers at Epic Prep Center in the link below. Thanks for your time today, Daniel. Really happy to talk to you and look forward to talking to you more. Cheers.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Hey, Amazon sellers. I hope you enjoyed this incredible episode with our fantastic guest, Daniel. To watch the full interview where Daniel talks about his Amazon seller journey and hear his method on how he was able to scale up to 13 million in sales, make sure to visit and subscribe to our YouTube channel. And don't forget to check out other podcasts on our channel to learn all the top tips and tricks for your Amazon business. If you have an Amazon business and need help winning the buy box to get more sales, join our community and try out a 14-day free trial for the best BeQL AI repricer and become the next Amazon top seller. See you soon. Thank you for listening. If you would like to stay connected with our weekly new episodes, subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, follow us on Spotify, or any other streaming platform you prefer. Let's continue our journey to become the next Amazon top seller.